Join the Guardian Social Enterprise Network today. It's the world's largest online community of social entrepreneurs and it's completely free. Visit guardian.co.uk/social podcast to register. The network gives you a space to share knowledge, discuss new ideas and promote best practice in delivering your enterprise's social mission and business objectives. Plus, you can create your free company profile to easily connect with your peers, potential customers, suppliers and commissioners. It can also increase your website traffic. Registering is quick and easy. Just sign up now at guardian.co.uk/social podcast.
The Guardian.
Hello and thanks for taking the time to listen. I'm Sean McGinty and I'm your host for the Guardian Social Enterprise Network podcast. This is podcast number 12. This month our subject is the international social enterprise movement. Coming up, I ask Christine Wilson, Head of Youth and Society Programmes at the British Council, that awkward question. Yeah, what's the downside for a despotic ruler of social enterprise? And how does social enterprise figure in the thinking of a government preparing for independence?
Making ourselves a world leader, a global leader, at least a European leader in terms of social enterprise.
That's Humza Yousaf, External Affairs Minister for the Scottish Government. More from him shortly. And this month, I get told off by Sophie Trenchell, who's the Chief Executive of Divine Chocolate, for getting it wrong.
So we make chocolate out of cocoa as a starting place, yeah?
But, yeah, I did correct myself,
twice!
More from that fascinating conversation with Sophie Trenchell from Divine Chocolate. And in the same segment, we'll hear what our representative body in the UK thinks about the international opportunities for social enterprises.
The Guardian.
The following interview with the British Council was researched and conducted by me without the knowledge they are a Guardian online sponsor. The interview is relevant to the subject and therefore it stays in the podcast. I tell you that so you know there's no funny business going on. Let's get on with it. So let's start this look at the international social enterprise scene by considering what our government does in our name abroad. No, not that. I'm talking about social enterprises. So a good place to start must be the British Council. They've got a presence all around the globe and a remit to build bridges and seek out opportunities to exchange ideas about society and development. I asked Christine Wilson, who's Head of Youth and Society Programmes, what the British Council's for.
So the British Council is the UK's body for international cultural relations. And by that we mean we're here to build trust and opportunities between peoples of the UK and people of the rest of the world. And we do that in a variety of ways. We work in education, in schools, further higher education. We work in the arts, we work through science, and we work very broadly in what we call society. And that's working with civil society, working with institutions and working with young people around the world who are looking to make a positive difference in their communities.
Now, as this movement of social enterprise kind of took hold in the UK, I guess you'd probably say in the main over the last 5 years, but certainly over the last 10 years there's been movement. Was that something that the British Council looked at and looked outwards internationally and said, other people are doing this, this must be good, this is the society?
Absolutely. I think for us, we recognised that there was something the UK had very interesting to say about social enterprise as it was developing. There's a significant history. You can go back to the Rochdale pioneers, the beginnings of the cooperative movement. There's real history in that linkage between civil society and business. And then I think we also realised that there's a huge diversity in the sector in the UK. You have a lot of very small startup organisations, and then you have some really significant global multinational companies, all of which are still social enterprises. There's a delightful fuzziness in the UK sector that I wouldn't characterise at all as a weakness. I think it's something that's really attractive because we can look at other countries where they are having dialogues about how civil society and business interact, where they're looking at new economic models because people see failures in the current one.
So what good does it do to the UK having the British Council sort of out there talking about social enterprise and connecting people up?
Well, I mean, in the sort of very old-fashioned sense, I guess we are showcasing UK expertise. We've a lot of British social entrepreneurs have gone out to various parts of the world. We focus a huge amount on East Asia, but also Eastern Europe, and they've gone and they've shared their experiences, they've shared their expertise, and they've made real connections. And that means that a lot of people are starting to come into the UK all of the time. They want to visit government departments, they want to see social enterprises on the ground, they want to see the support structures. They're increasingly talking about social investment. So there's a real two-way interaction, and people do look to the UK as a hub for expertise. But I think it's also about building trust. I think people recognise that the UK sector is really willing to talk very, very honestly about how things have developed, how the mistakes have been made, and how open the sector is to share those experiences. So from our point of view, you know, we're there to build trust, we're there to build opportunities, and this is definitely doing both.
What are the areas of the world where you see the most exciting development within social enterprise?
Well, increasingly I'm seeing it coming from everywhere, to be honest. You know,
we've got EU, it is everywhere.
The EU is really interested, colleagues in sub-Saharan Africa. There's interest in North Africa as well, because there are huge issues there about employability, and there are young people who are wanting to start their own businesses, who are extremely entrepreneurial, but they're also really interested in social value and the impact that what they do has on the community. So you see it very, very strongly there, and that's very exciting. I mean, personally, most of my experience has been in East Asia, and you see just phenomenal things happening there, and it's happening so quickly. So we supported the beginning of the Thai Social Enterprise Office, which is looking at their infrastructure. There's great work happening on the ground in China, and that means you're reaching millions of people and making differences to a huge amount of lives. I mean, Vietnam, it's really exciting the way they're working. I mean, and personally, because I've been out there a couple of times, in Burma, Myanmar, a country that's really opening up now to economic development and social development. It's happening very slowly, but it is happening. And there's huge possibilities there for the way that their economy can develop and open up for the wider public good. And I think the UK can really engage with that process.
And do there sometimes, I'm trying to think of a PC, an international word that will travel, do these sometimes difficult governments that perhaps rule these countries and areas of East Asia, do they get this? I mean, you'd think they'd stop this because it's very international. It's very about the people. It's empowering the people. And some governments clearly don't want that.
Well, I think people interpret in different ways. They come back to this glorious fuzziness and diversity we have within the UK sector. I've just been in a meeting this morning where the dreaded definition word came up.
Oh, dear.
And the point is that we have an enormous amount of flexibility within the UK sector. And I think people really appreciate that. So that can be translated quite happily into other countries. But the Chinese government and their Ministry of Civil Affairs are really excited about this. They're really excited. They're looking at the UK model and, you know, delivery of public services by social enterprise. Mm. But I think they also see enormous amounts of community development. The Chinese are investing heavily in community development. The government in Myanmar isn't quite so... We're not engaging with them in the same way. We're engaging very much with grassroots communities.
But nonetheless, they're letting you get on with it.
Absolutely, because I think people see a huge benefit where you look at social and economic development together.
Yeah, what's the downside for a despotic ruler of social enterprise? You know, I mean, I guess the people will be happier, but, you know, do they really care?
You're looking at economic development. I mean, there's a whole it's not just charity. It's just not granting aid. It's not just a foreign government coming in, handing over money. I mean, that tends to put people off, and often that isn't sustainable. What social enterprise and those sort of approaches bring about are economic development that can benefit a community. It can look to benefit a whole country. I know that's why the government of Thailand is really interested in social enterprise sort of being built into their wider economic strategy.
Thanks to Christine Wilson, who's Head of Youth and Society Programmes for the British Council. This is the Guardian Social Enterprise Network podcast, and I'm Sean McGinty. Remember the days when fair trade anything usually tasted like cardboard and you got them in a patchouli oil-scented shop full of hippies and old ladies? Well, it's not like that anymore. And one of the reasons is Divine Chocolate. Not only is the chocolate very edible indeed, but they're a company owned by the cocoa producers themselves. Peter Holbrook is the chief executive of Social Enterprise UK, and he sees the opportunities at home and abroad for like-minded social businesses. He joins the conversation a little after I asked Divine Chocolate's chief executive, Sophie Trenchell, how she got into chocolate / social enterprise.
Well, I responded to a very little advert in The Guardian in 1999, in May 1999. And then I went for the interview. And the rest is history.
What made you sort of... What was the thing that attracted you? I mean, was it just work? Or was it kind of, oh, that looks amazing?
No, I thought it was an irresistible combination. What they were doing was they were setting up the company. This was going to be a startup where I was going to be able to pick the team of people. They already had the brand, so they'd already got the idea of Divine, which I thought was a great name. They developed the first recipe, which is the milk chocolate recipe we still use today, which is a great recipe. And the farmers owned 33% of the company. And that was just, I thought, an irresistible business model of who wouldn't want to buy fantastic tasting chocolate that's called Divine, that where the farmers get the benefit because they actually own a significant share of the company.
Yeah, now you're a campaigning company, aren't you?
I mean, we are, yeah.
Who's listening to that campaign?
Well, I think first and foremost, the people who listened were people who love chocolate, actually. I think that people, if it hadn't been for people all over the country who heard what we were saying and went out of their way to get the shop that they go to stock Divine, we wouldn't be here today. Because we were a tiny, weeny company in the middle of London, and we were against... that we were coming into a market where you've got some of the biggest companies of the world in sort of Mars, Nestle and Cadbury's with the most enormous above-the-line advertising spends. And there we were with very little other than a really, really lovely idea and a fantastic product. And so what people did when they heard about our story was they actually went into supermarkets and asked for products that weren't there. They said to the supermarket manager, if you stock this product, we'll buy it and we'll get other people to buy it. And I think that without them, we couldn't have done it. So they definitely listened, and they're still listening to this day, and they've been amazing for us.
Now, you mentioned sort of large multinational food companies. Brands like Green and Black's, and I think there are others, they are owned by large multinational food companies. Yet, when you buy them, you kind of have this impression that it's somebody like you. Is that a problem for you?
Well, I'm interested in whether you really think that. Do you really think that still? And so I think people are becoming a bit more savvy. I think that the way that the media works now means that people have more access to that sort of information. But also, I do think, I mean, I think 5 years ago, you could have thought that Green and Blacks was a small company doing the right thing for the right reasons. I think with the level of publicity that the purchase, that Kraft's purchase of Cadbury's got, where Green and Blacks then was included in that, has meant, you know, anybody who actually bothers about those sorts of things is well aware that Green and Blacks is owned by Kraft Foods.
And do they still do the best thing for the business and the growers?
Well, obviously, I'm not going to say that, am I? Because I think we do. And so I think that what they do is they deliver some very good quality organic, if you like it, chocolate bars, where the farmers do get a fair trade price, which is good news for farmers. But in terms of what Divine does is we do so much more. But because the farmers own a significant share of the company, they have a say in how the company is run. They've started to understand the industry they're a part of, and they get a share of the profits. And so that if we were going to sell Divine to Kraft, then the people who would get to decide would be the farmers, and the people who would end up getting the money would be the farmers. And so it's a very different model of business where we are much more directly trying to improve the livelihoods of the cocoa farmers that supply the raw ingredients for the products that we all enjoy so much.
Yeah, I mean, does it you, as you sort of sit here now and look at your planning, you're looking at your cash flows as you go forward, you're looking at your business, you must have a lot of potential for growth, but how do you achieve that?
I suppose bit by bit. I think what we've been doing over the last year is over the last 18 months, we've been sort of commercialising our operation and bringing in some more people who really know, you know, how the industry works. And we're doing things like buying data. So we have a lot of data of our competitors in places like Waitrose and Sainsbury's. And then with that data, we can actually see what pieces of marketing that we do work and why it would be a good idea for supermarkets to stock more of our products. So we're approaching this more strategically. strategically, customer by customer, in a more commercial way. So I think that's one of the ways to do it. But we also need to carry on delivering fantastic products and continuing to be the company that people loved. We need to continue to inspire them to go out of their way to do something that they wouldn't have otherwise done. And so I think that that's part of it too. But your original question was who was listening.
Sure.
And I mean, I do think it's worth remembering that 12 years ago, so I started with the company 13 years ago, 12 years ago, fair trade was nearly unheard of. It was only really on coffee. It had a market awareness of about 10% and a retail value of a few million. This fair trade is now worth £1.3 billion in the UK retail market. 434 million of that is chocolate sales, bars with fair trade marks on them. That's 12% of the UK chocolate market now has a fair trade mark on it. The awareness level's at 80%. We've been part of creating a change that's been more successful than we could have ever imagined, really.
Do you think that...
So I think the big companies are listening.
Yeah, so they're adapting to that. The extra stuff, the extra sort of connections you make and the way that you source your raw material for the chocolate, what is the cost to that? I mean, what kind of cost does that put into your bottom line?
For every tonne of cocoa we buy, we pay $200 a tonne more for it. So at the moment, a tonne of cocoa is about $2,500. We're paying $200 above that market price for that cocoa, which the farmers get to decide how that money is spent, and it's invested in things like community projects and things. But we also dedicate 2% of our turnover to what we call producer support and development, which is recognising that if you're going to work with farmers in developing countries, in remote and rural areas where there are really high levels of illiteracy, then there are going to be things that come up that you're going to need to address, and that money helps you address those things, like having elections, like having training about cooperative principles and values, like having agricultural training. So all of those things come out of that 2% from our top line.
Peter Holbrook joins us now. Now, he's the chief executive of Social Enterprise UK and seems to have been to most parts of the world since he took on the role. Now, good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon.
International social enterprise, then, it must be a priority for Social Enterprise UK.
No, it's not, actually. I mean, our priority is absolutely serving the needs of our members here in the UK, but it seems a real waste of our knowledge and our experiences not to share, but also really importantly, not to learn from what's happening overseas. And of course, if there is the opportunity to do business and bring back cash and export our skills and our experience and our ideas, then of course we'd be foolish to limit ourselves only to trading within the UK. We are ourselves a social enterprise, of course.
What lessons can we take from international social enterprises? What are the sort of, you know, the places you've been to and the people you've spoken to and visited? What are the ones where, well, we can actually learn from them?
Well, there are some fantastic social enterprises emerging across East Asia. I've just been with Dr. Mari Mackay, who's from the British Council, based in Beijing. There's a huge need by the Chinese People's Republic to think about how it delivers public services in the future without necessarily creating a huge state infrastructure, how they can develop a robust and accountable and transparent civil society framework for delivering people's expectations as they get older. But right around the world, modernization of charities, looking at ways of diversifying income, there's a whole variety of different experiences and different drivers and catalysts for the kind of social enterprise interest that's right around the world right now.
What can they take from us in the UK? What have we got for them?
Well, we've got some fantastic leaders, so some inspiring people. So I think the journey that Sophie's been on at Divine, the journey that Tim has been on at Eden, demonstrating how social enterprise can regenerate, share wealth, be great business, doing well and doing good. But often they want legal models and they want the policy advice so that government can get the policy environment ripe so that social enterprises can thrive and succeed.
What was the most surprising thing that you found sort of when you were looking at other countries around the world? You know, the sort of place where you went in and just went, wow, look at that, you know, never thought that would work.
I think the challenge and the opportunities within kind of the Asian economies is absolutely fascinating. And the genuine sense that they want to learn and share their experiences with us makes for a phenomenal piece of diplomatic opportunity, as well as for trading and exporting within a very, very exciting part of the world.
Mm.
I think in the US, there's been, you know, without there being kind of so much state provision, there has been a whole variety of community activity which has emerged as a consequence. And that's very exciting too.
How does it go back to you, Sophie? How did the people on the ground, you know, I don't know how you open up kind of new, if you like, you know, places to buy coffee for cocoa from, but how do the locals sort of react to you? What do? You knock on the door and go, we want to spend more money on the coffee, the cocoa you're producing? How does it work?
So we make chocolate out of cocoa as a starting place, yeah?
But, yeah, I did correct myself, honest.
Twice!
Wow. But cool, you're hard work today, aren't you?
The sort of, in a way, you've got this upside down. So that what happened was Kwapa Cocoa, the farmers' cooperative in Ghana, set up in 1993, and their opportunities to set up was the liberalisation of the market. So that was both a threat and an opportunity, and some charismatic farmers thought that was an opportunity to set up an organisation run by farmers for farmers. They have an annual general meeting where two people come from each village to ensure women's participation. And in their AGM in 1997, where they had 1,200 people turn up, they voted to set up a chocolate company in the UK. And Divine is that chocolate company. So they own us, they can sack me, and they can say they want me to sell more chocolate, sort of, in a way. And so that at the moment, Divine has only sourced its cocoa from Kwapa Cocoa. Kwapa Cocoa has 65,000 members. A third of them are women, which means 21,000 of them are women. They deliver 40,000 tons of cocoa. That's nearly 6% of Ghana's cocoa and 1% of the world's. They're a big organisation that's got enough cocoa for us to buy. But it doesn't mean we're not looking for other farmers. So a few years ago, we worked with farmers in Sierra Leone, and so did Kwapa Cocoa, so did the farmers from Ghana. And they helped them develop their organisation. They helped them to develop their cooperative and their agricultural skills. And then we bought some of their cocoa in order to help them get into the market. So that's sort of how that works for us. But in terms of international social enterprises, in a way, you know, fair trade companies are versions of that. So in the same model of Divine, there is a nut company called Liberation, which does Harry's Nuts and also does lots of fair trade own brand supermarket nuts. And they are owned by nut farmers in Malawi, nut farmers in Asia, in India, and nut farmers in Latin America. And so it means they can offer a selection of nuts that sort of is how people eat nuts. And then Cafe Direct is obviously the trailblazer. So they are really one of the first companies in Britain to be a social enterprise, to say there is a different way of doing business, and to show that there is a consumer base that actually is prepared to pay more for a product that they know where the money's going. And they're now, I think, sourcing from something like 28 countries, and they deliver coffee, tea and drinking chocolate.
Well, your model that you said that you've got there, is that something where you could see it happening in another product area, in another industry?
Well, yeah. Yes. No, I mean, I think there's lots of potential for people who are producers of both commodities and sort of people who make things to set up brands that they sell. There's some very nice examples of people, you know, who make shoes and sell them directly. There's lots of examples of ways of doing it. I think the chocolate market's a very big, mature and competitive market to come into. So it might be good to do it in a more targeted way, in a more niche way, where you work with a particular country that has a specific relationship with you. One of the advantages of doing Divine is that Ghana is the source of cocoa for our market leader chocolate products. So people like the taste of chocolate made with cocoa from Ghana. Ghana is also on the same meridian, so they are awake at the same time as us. And they, because they were an ex-British colony, they speak English as their official language, so they can come here and they can talk to people and people can understand it. So there's lots of things that make that relationship work. And if you were going to set up another business that was doing something using the same model, it would be worth looking at the things that made it work and also the things that made it challenging.
What are the opportunities then, do you think, Peter, for UK social enterprises looking internationally? I mean, it's an interesting model, the way Divine have sort of done it, kind of reverse engineering it almost. But for companies that are here in the UK and they want to sort of trade abroad, what are the opportunities there?
Well, look, social enterprises operating in public service markets are finding it quite difficult. All of the innovation and a lot of the kind of new product launches are in consumer-facing markets. And that's really, really positive. These markets are vast. They are worth billions and billions and billions of pounds. And we must be able to find a way to demonstrate that we can operate our businesses in different ways, ways that are fair, in essence, ways that share wealth, and prosperity and opportunity, and still take their place, you know, in these global markets, as Sophie at Divine has done, as have Cafe Direct, Pants to Poverty. There's a whole variety of new consumer-facing brands that can sell on a global stage. And increasingly, as people wake up, that they don't want to do business in its ordinary, usual, profiteering, greedy way, you know, we are building an ever greater resonance with consumers. And I think that's a fantastic opportunity. We're scratching the surface at the moment. I think this is one of the really, really big opportunities for social enterprises to build, you know, genuinely global brands that transform communities and people's perception of what social enterprise is all about.
What part of the world offers the greatest opportunity for UK social enterprises?
Okay, well, I think, you know, a couple of points just there. I think there's a huge opportunity for an explosion of social enterprises within Europe in a reaction to kind of Greece and the whole kind of issue around the broken economy of Europe, looking for new ways to kind of rebuild Europe's economy. And I think the European Commission are going to do some very interesting work in the next couple of years. China as a consumer market, absolutely massive. All of those big Asian markets provide an opportunity to talk to a whole new generation of consumers about provenance, about ethics, about values and supply chains. So, of course, in terms of export opportunities, those big markets, you know, we'll have to kind of engage with, and they should be super huge opportunities as long as we've got the scale to be able to take, you know, take those opportunities. But I think right around the world, I think, you know, we live in such a globalized world now, you know, tech companies are connecting people. These issues around supply chains and how the Apple tablet that you're using in front of you, the impact that has on the production line, you know, perhaps in China, you know, people are much more aware than they've ever been. And I think actually, if you're asking about where the real opportunity exists, it's about engaging and talking to a whole new generation of consumers that are much more interested in things simply other than price.
Sophie, different question to you to sort of finish off, and that is, do you see a day when the big supermarkets, I know some of them do in some areas, but the big supermarkets kind of look at the way they buy from abroad more in the way you do?
I think some of the supermarkets do look at their supply chains more than others. I think the thing that's complicated is, I mean, so one of the things that's happened in Britain is you've seen a huge growth in Britain of own label products. So that's products that when you go into Sainsbury's, you're buying Sainsbury's own label and not Findus, say. And that requires an enormous amount of expertise, of time, of resources. And so they do need to make a conscious commitment to make that move. It's not something you can do overnight, because you're actually sort of shifting a tanker in terms of changing the emphasis of what you're doing, where buyers up to now are mainly tasked with buying the cheapest product, which they can get away with in order to deliver a product that fits the niche that they've been asked to fit. Mm. Whereas actually this is saying there's more to this than that. And so that's actually, you're needing to shift the culture of buyers working in big institutions and in multinational companies. And so I think that's a big challenge. But I think there is now a growing amount of people who recognise, and you know, and this horse meat scandal shows you, the risk of not taking on more than the price of a product when you go to source it.
Thanks to Sophie Tranchell from Divine Chocolate and Peter Holbrook from Social Enterprise UK. I'm Sean McGinty, and this is the Guardian Social Enterprise Network podcast. So the opportunities are there for UK social enterprises, and the UK includes Scotland, right? Well, it does at the moment, but as we know, that might change. And the Scottish Government, as well as edging towards the exit from the UK, says it's marching boldly towards becoming a social enterprise world leader. So I asked External Affairs Minister for the Scottish Government, Humza Yousaf, what he thinks social enterprise can deliver for Scotland internationally.
Oh, well, a huge amount, actually. It's, you know, social enterprise has been a kind of cornerstone, I think, of our growth strategy at home, but also we've seen the international aspect and how important it can be internationally too. You know, I personally work in international development, and people wouldn't necessarily put social enterprises together with development and aid. Most people would think about development and aid being about, you know, building hospitals or building schools and so on and so forth. But actually, it's you know, we've had quite a lot of successful projects. People are moving, NGOs are moving more towards social enterprise models in the international development field. I suppose the other way internationally, you know, it's about attracting some of the big global social enterprise headquarters to Scotland and making ourselves a a world leader, a global leader, at least a European leader in terms of social enterprise. So that's part of the announcement that was made by the First Minister about the International Social Enterprise Programme. You know, this kind of pot of money to attract and to retain global headquarters of social enterprises to Scotland.
Is it about bringing social enterprises to Scotland in terms of helping the Scottish economy? Or I guess I'm talking to you as External Affairs Minister for the Scottish Government. Or is it both? Are you looking outwards and sort of drawing in?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely is about both. We know how it can help, and we have seen the effects of how social enterprise has helped here in Scotland, but it's got a huge role to play internationally as well. But, you know, that work can be carried out and can be led from Scotland and from Scottish headquarters. So, for example, with international development, the work that I do, you know, we fund some projects where, the International Network of Street Papers, based here as a social enterprise in Scotland, do work in Malawi, in Namibia, in Zambia, in Ethiopia. For example, in Malawi, the big issue is now got an addition over in Malawi. So, they're tackling problems like homelessness, like unemployment, like poverty. The big issue is branding out into Malawi as well. So it's definitely about helping those in some extraordinarily difficult circumstances. I think the other way it's helping too, and the two aren't always linked, but certainly I've noticed in my role as External Affairs Minister that microfinance is becoming a hugely important aspect of projects moving forward, and there's a natural synergy there, I think, with microfinance projects and social enterprise too. So yeah, I think it's going to play a more relevant role internationally, and I think it's good that Scotland's in the driving seat.
As you sit here, sort of a little while before there's a vote to go independent as an independent nation, how important do you think it would be, your social enterprise ties internationally, how important is that when you're looking at Scotland being an independent nation, which is what you want?
Yeah, I mean, it goes to the heart of the debate, regardless of which side of you're on in the debate. The very heart of the debate is about what kind of Scotland we want to be, and what kind of nation we aspire to become. And so, where do we want to lead the world? Now, it would be great to lead the world in every single sector that you possibly can, but where does Scotland have expertise? And I think with the approach we've taken to social enterprise in the last few years, we're really ranking ourselves near the top of those who have an innovative approach. So in terms of the independence debate, yes, there's a lot that we can do with the power that we have, and we demonstrate that, and we use the powers that we have to the very best of our ability. But actually, imagine what more we could do as an independent nation with complete control over all the economic tax levers, fiscal levers, and in our own hands, in our own parliament. Think how we could use those resources and those levers to further enhance what we do with social enterprise, and using Scottish expertise, be that in renewable energy or any other field, it'd be quite fascinating and quite an interesting prospect.
Final quick question. If I speak to you as, if you've not been promoted, external Affairs Minister in an independent Scottish government, mm-hmm. say in 3 years' time, what country in the world would you expect you'd be doing most trade with?
Oh, wow. Well, undoubtedly, actually, our biggest partner would still be the rest of the UK. I mean, the rest of the UK is our biggest export market currently. And we fully intend to be a member of the EU. I suppose the only question is whether or not the rest of the United Kingdom is still within the European Union. I imagine people will still vote for it regardless of the in-out referendum. And so I fully expect the rest of the United Kingdom to still be our biggest export market.
Thanks there to Humza Yousaf, External Affairs Minister from the Scottish Government.
The Guardian.
So here's how you get in touch. You can email me at seanmcginty.co.uk or david.mills@guardian.co.uk. If you're on Twitter, tweet us your thoughts to @guardiansockent, or my old personal Twitter is @seanamcginty. Please remember to share us with your friends and colleagues in the usual way. Next month, we're talking about startups in social enterprise. So any ideas, please send them my way. I'm Sean McGinty. Thanks for listening, and see you next time for more news, comments and information from the Guardian Social Enterprise Network. You should join it. It's free.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Join the Guardian Social Enterprise Network today. It's the world's largest online community of social entrepreneurs, and it's completely free. Visit guardian.co.uk/socialpodcast to register. The network gives you a space to share knowledge, discuss new ideas, and promote best practice in delivering your enterprise's social mission and business objectives. Plus, you can create your free company profile to easily connect with your peers, potential customers, suppliers, and commissioners. It can also increase your website traffic. Registering is quick and easy, so sign up now at guardian.co.uk/socialpodcast.